Well, perhaps we could begin by talking about your childhood and your family, and moving then quickly on to your pre-college education.
Yes.
You were born in Copenhagen.
Yes. Yes, my father was a military engineer, and the most interesting thing about him is maybe that in the early years of this century, he was leading an effort to together with us to create an organization that could, as you put it, keep the wheels running under general lockout or general strikes. And that organization developed to be the largest private organization in our country, and had a large number of members in all parts of our small country. And actually, it served a role after the First World War, where, for many political reasons on the continent and here, there was a substantial effort to redo society, to dislodge our monarchy also, and convert it into a radical leftist society. And this took the form of big fights everywhere in Europe, by the way, in the labor market, general strikes, lockouts, to what have you, where in a way you took society as a hostage to interests, particularly the leftists. We had a strong leftist movement, and we had a crisis or several crises just after the war, which caused changes in government and movements to change this country to maybe a republic. And this society called Samfundshjælpen means assistance to society or something like that, kept the wheels running. And it was, shall we say, created in some other countries on the model created in this country. Because the important thing was that A, it had to be very broad.
Mm.
B, it had to be so organized that it could really do things on short notice. And C, it had to be privately funded without any monies coming from one or the other sector of society. But of course, basically, it had a conservative role in the manner that it wanted to maintain the, shall we say, the good things in the structure we had, and by evolution modernize. And this was such a such an organization was created also in other Scandinavian countries, Germany, England, and in Germany it grew to be very, very big, and unfortunately it was used much later by Hitler as a vehicle to create SA. And in England it was headed by Lord Jellicoe, and also had not negligible role. And obviously, therefore, I grew up very much in the atmosphere that this activity created. It was a very substantial part of my father's life. It was also interesting for in another way, because in Denmark, as by the way, these other countries, it created a climate, you might say, a vehicle for all non-revolutionary political quarters and parties to gather and say, fine, we can fight, for instance, the labor market, we can fight for working conditions, for wages, and what have you. But we cannot take society as a hostage. we must stop ahead of that. Of course, that's a nice idea, but if you really examine it, it isn't possible completely to avoid that, because now, for instance, we have hospitals taken hostage, and therefore the society taken hostage by a threatened strike by the personnel in hospitals. But to a certain extent, it was successful, across a broad spectrum of political parties and groupings, you could work together. And it was quite amazing for me that the leaders of the Social Democrats, which at that time was considered by established society as quite leftist, they all of them came to be very good friends of the family, and my father, of course, and later myself. And you might say that created an interest in many quarters, and certainly also for me, to see this possibility of when it came to important matters, to basic fundamental questions, it was amazing how you could gather maybe 80, maybe 90% of the population around similar views, although some came from the extreme, not extreme, but from the military establishment, some came from workers' groups and so on. And that, of course, for many of us meant that it was, shall we say, a goal in itself to create a real understanding and collaboration between these 80%. And also it showed how if you took the old pre-First World War establishment run by a fairly small group in all European countries, by the way also in the States, then it was no longer possible to base development on the views of this establishment, that you had to bring in the shall we say, the worker class. I hate the word, but okay. Mm-hmm. And therefore it's always meant a lot to me that even in daily life, one has to accept the necessity of collaboration between all groupings, from the man on the floor to the professor on the cathedral. And in a way, the whole circle to which I think my wife and I feel we belonged, quite a broad circle, they shared this. Some even came from communism, you might say. They were reformed Marxists, or got to be reformulated Marxists. And that meant a lot to me, and still does. Otherwise, we were two brothers, had a privileged life.
It's easy to see how your interest in economics, science, engineering, and technology would come out of that excitement surrounding,
yes,
your father's activities. What I was wondering,
to a certain extent, yes.
To a certain extent, what I was wondering was, in your early formal education, were those interests that you could follow?
not during my formal education. I studied at university here, technical university as called today, and Copenhagen University, and spent equal time with physics and chemical engineering. but we had many study circles around 1930,
mm-hmm.
where you could follow this. And then when my wife and I got engaged to be married, then her father's activities came into my life. And he was for many, many years chairman of a private organization that was responsible for education of young people in economy, in practical economy,
sure.
not in university type macroeconomy, but in teaching young people to run businesses, to sell and buy, and to analyze economics of their business. And this society, the private NGO, grew to be very, very large, and created then an economic university that is still growing, very active here. And therefore, I got involved also in helping him, or in discussing with him and the group around this NGO, how best to create education for, as they were, it was originally, the organization had a peculiar name. It was called Forening til Unge Handelsmænds Uddannelse. And literally translated, that means the Society for the Education of Young Business People. And that then created these university type things. Well, they have a large number of professors now. And in the 30s, my wife and I got engaged to be married in 33. You see, in those years you were engaged to be married, and then after some years you married when you could support,
right.
support the girl. And this was the time when this grew rapidly. And there was an understanding, growing understanding, although slowly growing understanding everywhere in Europe. In the States was different, that any industrial science, scientific activity or anything like that in a way had no meaning. It wasn't married to business, to doing business, and to what we in this company call business engineering, creating business through analysis and development. And therefore, I'd always been somewhat interested in this, because many members of family and the circle of friends were in business. And therefore, during these years when I studied, I also had opportunity to follow the development of education in applied economics, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
I also took a great interest in study circles and otherwise, in different ideas on how to try and convert macroeconomic studies into a science, which of course has not been successful so far, and will never be, by the way. But I got very much interested in the possibilities, logical thinking, you might say, and logical analysis and statistical studies had to create a picture of macroeconomic developments, situations and developments. And already during my study years, some of us got very much involved in that. And some of us then took job, went to be presidents of national bank, president of banks, or ministers, or department heads. In some, and one of them, by the way, just died. And, was really Mr. Economics in Denmark, Mr. Smith. And we were very close friends from we were small. And we were many, many of us who tried to see where can the sciences and economic studies collaborate and what are the limits for economic information, what are their validity, under which conditions do they remain valid, for how long a time can an economic study of a country, for how long a time can that mm-hmm. picture remain valid, to what extent is economic development depending on technical development, and you might say we focused, some of us, and I did, and even wrote a book about it, about input-output things.
Right.
And I think some people say I was the first who did modern input-output work in this book. And I had many activities in different parts of the world, universities and so on, in that relation. Many people came also to study a little bit. And I think it's natural if you are interested in the role of the sciences to bring about development. Development has no meaning if it's only seen as technological development or competence or knowledge development. It only has a meaning to society. I mean, I'm not saying that it isn't wonderful to know how matter, ultimate particles, are behaving. But if you look apart from the science for science, which of course I love more than anything else, but if you look, if you don't look at that, abstract from that, then obviously science has no meaning unless it's a basis for development, applied science, moving into technical, technological, industrial, business, trading areas. And all that has no meaning if you cannot, in a way, convert it into economic activities and describe it in economic terms. I mean, if you have developed a new process, as for instance Ralph Landau, and which at the time he and I participated a little bit also in these areas, we looked at it. We didn't know that it would have any practical use at all. But then, of course, to develop further, to continue the activities, you came to crossroads where the justification for the work and the importance of the work had to be described in economic terms. So in a way you might say that it has no meaning for private sector purposes to do fundamental work if you don't look at how do you make your first sale, that's money. How do you finance the first plant, that's money. What impact does it have on the market, that's money, and social impacts and so on. So I must admit that for those years I very much hoped that I could stick with science for science and go into university. But because of the crisis, that wasn't possible, so I had to go into business. And then it has no meaning to study theoretical business, physics in business if you don't have an economic, financial knowledge, competence, and interest. And these things, what I try to explain, my father's work, my father-in-law's activities, the whole circle's mm-hmm. attitudes and activities, meant that the company we set up from the beginning until this day is equally emphasizing science and business. The people we admire here are the professors and the salesmen, equally.
If I could ask another question about the input-output method,
yes.
or technique, I was interested to read something that you wrote comparing, I think, your work of 1935 with the input-output methods to analyze the economic situation of Denmark, to energy material calculations that the chemical engineer does routinely. Was that something that you were consciously thinking about? The connection between the type of analysis that you were doing in your, with your input-output method in economics and what you were studying in physical chemistry, physics, and chemical engineering.
Yes, well, it sure has a connection, because if you want to describe the situation of a country, a society, group of countries, and how you could expect it to develop, how the impact on social developments and economic developments would be on new technologies, for instance, on new energy situations, then of course you had to know how would be the interaction between all sorts of input factors to output in any sector of industry. And my interest was therefore to gain an understanding of the relationship between actual business operations. A business meaning in this respect almost everything that dealt with things you can weigh. Agriculture, industry, small scale businesses, households, what have you. And if you had such a picture of a country, then obviously you can only do it by assembling a very large number of statistical data. And you could then say to yourself, the nice thing would of course be if you could carve it up into very small sectors. And it's just not possible to do that, because the statistical apparatus does not permit that. You cannot get valid data if you split it up in two small sectors. So I tried to split it up in a number of more or less traditional sectors. But then, of course, you then have the problem of what is the validity of such a picture? How long will it last?
Right.
And what will push it to change? And many things will push it to change. Psychological things, the attitude in the market will push it to change. It's very difficult to evaluate. One of the main reasons why economy will never be a science. And scientific developments. Obviously, we don't need to go much into detail there, but take, for instance, the Green Revolution that completely changed agriculture with the advent of heavy chemical industry making fertilizers, insecticides, and what have you. That completely changed the chemical industry. We can take more recent examples, take the Thai restaurant, for instance, or new developments in automotive technology. And therefore, I thought that it was interesting if you wanted to do work which, based on science, could come up with new processes, new products, to see what would likely, for social reasons or general economic reasons, desired change in society, what that would that demand from technology and science, and vice versa, new scientific discoveries, what would they eventually lead to in production products that would impact society, and how would they do that? And I was very much interested in also seeing how that would work, not only on a national level, but also on international levels. In other words, I tried to identify that part of the economic activities that could be analyzed and put, where you could put numbers you were sure on, and then find out what is the limit of validity for such an analysis, and how, what would change the situation. I thought that was very interesting, and I have still maintained relations with many people around the world who have been involved in such matters. Unfortunately, many of the so-called economists, they fight a completely meaningless battle trying to make all of us believe that there isn't really economic science in the way you term physics a science, for instance. And that's meaningless. The beauty of economic activities is that it is not a science, that it is a tool to study situations and study possible consequences of new impacts, new situations. It's a beautiful tool for that, but for many, many reasons, including the fact that it cannot put numbers on the market's reactions, on people's reactions in a democracy like ours, as the ultimate decision makers' reactions. Not put numbers on that. Therefore, the advisory possibilities having necessarily to be based on forecasts can never be based on solid fundamentals.
Right.
Can never. But nevertheless, I mean, we need them. And it's always been an unpleasant thing for me that there's almost a complete watertight separation between the sciences, which can deal, deal with facts, very often misinterpreted, very often incomplete facts, very often influenced by the desire people have to see certain results, like for instance all the environmental people, the green people. But you simply have to find a way of making use of the economists in collaboration with the people working in science and technology. And it's always been a mystery to me that they cannot talk to each other. I feel that sometimes I'm the only one who can talk with those parties if we are sitting in a group. And of course it's sheer nonsense that the way the economists try and advise us. I mean, all the governments all over the world almost, they have an economic advisory board, and in this board there are only economists. That's ridiculous. I mean, it has no meaning at all. Therefore you have this fight: do we prime the bomb as Keynes would do, or do we look only at monetary principles as Buber, as the German Bundesbank does? It is a completely meaningless discussion.
Yeah, I think just as a progressive side note,
that was a long
very interesting.
From the historian's point of view, you see a lot of economics in the late 19th century coming out of Britain and Germany in particular, where they get their ideals that bother you so much. They see the success of thermodynamics and electromagnetic physical research, and then they look to those models as a way of making their own science scientific, which is why it's interesting to hear you as an engineer talking about these models, but with a very different set of expectations than the economists had in their early years.
You see, of course, it's also very interesting. You can, as we all have to do, you can see to what extent economic tools is useful for a company. And I've always hoped that somehow the vision of one world would come true. I mean, it's we are very far from that. Partly we are working in the opposite direction. But nevertheless, we see some attempts to globalize the economy. Many people even brag about having globalized the economy, which is sheer nonsense. But if you look at a company, it's of course very important today with this international competition. It's very important to at least understand economic development, social development alternatives, then to watch is this market emphasizing employment, in which case you can expect certain prime the pump activities and so on. Is this market looking for a strictly Friedman type policy, in which case you can expect an emphasis on other matters, for instance preference for business in the private sector instead of seeing governments as businessmen, which I personally hate, because not because you can't have a government running business, but you cannot find politicians capable of doing it.
I would like to ask about how you came to your interest in catalysis specifically.
Yes, well, I mean, surely I did spend time on what you could call social, economic, employment matters,
right,
and so on. I should, if you will permit me, go back one thing. I mean, you asked what, so in my younger years, formative, I don't know where I was formed, but formative years, you asked a little bit about that. I can tell you one thing, that people my age, if they are anywhere decent, will never forget. That is the fantastic social catastrophe of the unemployment around 30. And this caused Nazism and many other things more than anything else. And I had some English in the circle, we had some English friends, family, and some of them were involved in the steel industry. And for instance, in Middlesbrough, practically everybody was out of work. And you'd see in our rich country, because even in that respect, at that situation, we were rich because we had all we could eat and much more. So you could see in our town here thousands of people stand lining up in a queue to get a cup of soup. And you'll never forget that. You will never have the same view as some of these monetarists, which of course are not really meaning when they say that they don't give a hoot about employment, they give a hoot about money availability and budget balance and so on. Of course they don't mean it, because with a few exceptions, I've known most of them, and they're not that sort of cynical people. They just mean that there's this other road to development and progress. But I mean, a road can take so long that it's simply inhuman to travel that road. And therefore, whenever you think about all these things, if there's anything like a small risk of having a situation like in Western Europe, very much in Middlesbrough, Wales, Copenhagen, to say nothing about Germany, where I would say the refugees from Kosovo, they are no worse off than the suffering unemployed people, then you take another view about economy. Because I have no doubt that many things can produce better results after 10 years than what we have to look at in order to avoid social catastrophes on the way to paradise. And I got very much upset when you found here in recent years in Western Europe that most of our political leaders didn't give a hoot about the unemployment. Then all of a sudden, a year or two ago, they start finding that that may be a good idea to get re-elected to emphasize that. But all those who are saying that, and I think I know most of them, well, I know many of them, they, years ago, you couldn't even discuss it with them. You couldn't even discuss economic, political alternatives in the context of employment. And basically, even very, very often, you have people who place other ideas like some neo-Marxistic ideas people still have ahead of the really day-to-day attention to employment. And excuse me for coming, going back to that.
That's interesting. Very interesting.
And this is a catastrophe. I'm one of the few ones still active who have really lived with this situation. When I started, most of us didn't give a job. My father said, if I want to study, of course I could study, but I would enter an academic proletariat, which apparently was worse than the general proletariat. Okay, you had a question about catalysis.
That's right. I was just interested to know how you came to your specific interest in catalysis.
You, right now you sound like an economist to me.
I'm sorry?
You sound like an economist right now, not like a chemical engineer. And I don't know, that may be another way to phrase the question.
Yeah,
how did you?
That's what I'm moving toward.
Yeah. Okay. apart from what shall we say, the outlook I had from my from families, from friends, and so on, I took an interest as a teenager in different things. I didn't know quite exactly what I wanted to be. I've always had a little bit of a problem because anything you get involved in presents to me an interest per se in itself.
Right.
I don't buy this business that people say geography, that's not my cup of tea. I'm not interested in geography or economy or geology or physics or what have you. I don't buy that because almost anything, even apart from my daily life, detailed trading, if you dive into it, it has an interest. So I always had the problem that I felt that anything I read about, that must be interesting. architecture. but I was most interested in physics and chemistry, in the sciences. I saw physics and chemistry as almost one thing because I hope that's something we may talk about later would happen. So I wasn't terribly interested in engineering, but I was interested in physics and chemistry. But in order to marry, I had to do something where I could get a job. So therefore, I took the exam from the engineering university, it wasn't called a university at that time. And I got a job. But when war came, then this job was no longer available, so to speak. And so we wanted to go to the United States and work in catalysis. But because of German occupation, we could not travel. So we, my wife and I said, well, let us see where we can put together something that can be ready when war ends. We were pessimists at that time because I knew Germany very well and thought it wouldn't end so quickly. But then I was considering either to go into catalysis or into bio. Bio is also, it was the enzymatic portion of bio I was interested in. That's also catalysis, you might say. And then we were a few people, all of them graduated from the university here and assembled. And I could find a very small sum of money, you would say today, but at that time enough to get started. And were some 5 to 10 people. And we could quite at very early time install ourselves in some laboratories. That's all described in the book. And we then selected catalysis, partly because all of us were, with different emphases, interested in physics, theoretical physics, and in chemistry. All of us were interested both in the fundamental sciences and in bringing it into something you could earn your money on and survive. Oh, common people. Good. Let me say, we assembled then, and some of them who joined us got to be quite well known. And the last of the early friends, he just turned 80 and just retired. And we did not want to live on support from government or things like that. We did not want to depend on such support. We didn't mind having some help, obviously not, but we could manage with the help we got from family and family friends. And therefore we had to think about how can we survive economically. Fortunately, we had some very good friends in Sweden, and we could do most of our work, even in Denmark, for our outfit in Sweden. We selected catalysis because of our interest, but also because we thought that catalysis would have a tremendous growth potential. And that was correct, indeed, to say the least. Secondly, because we thought that we might have a chance of earning money in two ways, by bringing research results into the market in the form of catalysts we could manufacture, and in the form of catalytic processes, and maybe a third way also in the form of specialized reactors. And all this has proven to be possible. So it was, it would have been impossible to select an area where we didn't think we could earn enough money to continue and develop. That would have been impossible. And fortunately, we thought we could select an area where we had our interest. And again, of course, that means that the selection was derived from some sort of economic analysis. Why would catalysis spend a larger role? Because of foreseeable developments in fertilizers, in oil refining. And this is where we put our efforts in these areas. We did not at that time think of ecology, where also air cleaning is an important client to catalysis. Did I answer?
Yes. A if I could follow up on that, I would like to know what gave you confidence that you could come up quickly.
Optimism was our main raw material, as it always has to be for something new. We thought we had the energy and the knowledge that would bring results. We were too optimistic as to the time and effort, and particularly after the war years, we were maybe starting many research projects with maybe too optimistic view about how quickly they would bring results, but we had some luck, and we had also logically analyzed where to put our efforts, and then of course we were willing to live to a certain extent on a shoestring for many years. Well, you can also say something unpleasant, that when we looked around the world, and some of us did know a good deal of the world already then, we weren't enormously impressed by the efficiency, particularly efficiency, but also intelligence, of those we had to compete with. And that was, of course, arrogant. But unjustified optimism and strong emphasis on work and arrogance, they are necessary.
Confidence, anyway.
I'm sorry?
Confidence. I mean, you have to be convinced in yourself.
I don't think, as far as I'm concerned, I have great difficulty in being confident about things.
Arrogance comes.
Well, yes, but I'm always very much pessimistic about things, and in a way, my standard dream ends up by me saying to myself, "How the hell can this go on?" Something like that. Optimism and confidence are two completely different things.
One is irrational.
Yes.
Sorry.
Well, there are two things that I'm very interested in hearing more about, one of which is your ideas about the relation between physics and chemistry. I'd like to talk to you about that. And I'd also like to talk about some of the early developments with the firm, the first technologies, that sort of thing. That's entirely up to you where you'd like to go next.
Okay, let us start with the relationship between physics and chemistry. Now, if we go back to my study years, then the scientific foundation of chemistry was rather scant. The best anchors were to be found in thermodynamics, and obviously we had the benefit of Gibbs's thermodynamic system and many other who worked with him or after him. And here in Denmark we had a specific benefit of the work by S.B.L. Sørensen and later by Brønsted. thermodynamics, of course, in a way explicable only if you go into particle physics, solid state physics, and so on. So although the main laws were formulated before people had more than a hunch about quantum physics, particle physics, and all that sort of thing, then you might say that in a way classical thermodynamics have more a character of a very useful postulation that really cannot be understood from basic principles. And therefore, we had a very good situation in the Copenhagen University by the work of a number of very fine theoretical chemists, and by the school that Brønsted created, where we also had many foreigners coming, and not the least a large number of American chemists. If you look upon the use of the utility of the chemical science to developments at that time, obviously it's nice to know about thermodynamics, it's nice to know what is possible, and it's nice to know that the whole world around us is thermodynamically unstable or metastable or so on, and really shouldn't be there if all reactions that were thermodynamically possible took place. That's very nice to know, and you feel very impressed by this business that the whole world around us is unstable. What, of course, one didn't know too much about at the time was kinetics. And surely one had started some work in different parts of the world to understand a little bit kinetics, and one, of course, understood that in catalysis, kinetics, that in many, many, many cases it was an interaction between surfaces and continua on the both sides of the surface, maybe. One, of course, also knew that you had homogeneous catalysis, where no doubt the fundamental patterns were different. We were interested in heterogeneous catalysis, so let me stay with that. And in the 30s, quite a few came up with all sorts of ideas, but they were of a very speculative nature in a way. I mean, it's easy to say that if you can create combustion by putting a high surface compound, platinum maybe, into a gaseous mixture, then it's easy to say that there must be some parts of the area which are responsible for this, because if it was a completely homogeneous situation, it would either be bang or nothing. And therefore people came with these ideas about active sites and all that, and then people thought that in catalysis acidity would be of importance, and people looked at the different types of acidity. Even today, one is not, I would say, in a completely sound, on a completely sound footing when talking about acidity. because if you look away from simple questions in aqueous surroundings, then it ain't that easy to say what one means with Lewis and Bronsted acidity and all that sort of thing. But one spoke a lot about that, and we thought that was interesting. And then, of course, one was then forced to look a little bit more upon what is really a surface. The interplay between physics and fundamental chemistry, which after all, almost without exception, has to do with the structure of solids, with emphasis on surface structure, and with kinetics. Then the interplay was not too efficient. And that mainly was because in physics you had this tremendous development starting in the 10th, also between 1910 and 20, with the idea of the quanta relativity, Planck, and all these people starting it, and then Einstein and Bohr coming up, and you therefore put enormous interest in the advent of the particle physics, quantum physics, relativity physics, and all the interplays there. You put enormous interest in the energy situation around atoms, atom electron business, Bohr's famous model, and on atomic physics in general. And of course then you had, as we all know, the advent of the isotope chemistry with Urey and Hevesy, are both good friends. Hevesy, a very close friend of the family. And and there came into the creation of artificial isotopes, of radioactive isotopes, and you got the whole business of the fission and, well, maybe it comes, maybe it doesn't, fusion physics. So people were so enthusiastic about that, and really it was a fantastic development. One had here in Denmark the great advantage of the so-called Copenhagen School around Niels Bohr. Niels Bohr was my teacher. He and his family were very close family friends. My wife and I enjoyed a very close relationship with him and Mrs. Bohr, widow, and children. And of course we were all very enthusiastic about it. I indeed, if I had been able to select, would have liked to join that. Now, this meant that the work one did in physics was of only scant use to chemistry under the conditions chemistry then lived, with the standpoint chemistry then had. I would venture to say that I have known only a couple of chemists from those years who could even understand what the physicists were doing. A few of them famous, like Enrico Fermi, like Hevesy. But for instance, Bronsted and his school did not understand what the theoretical physicists were doing, and did not really follow it, and did not see it as a tool to be developed also for understanding of chemistry. And then another thing was of importance, that in physics, that from the science community and from university community around the world, had much more support and interest and money than the chemists. They very rarely took interest in solid-state physics. You can be a little bit naughty and say that it was maybe difficult enough for them to understand the atom model and to understand the interplay of particles, atoms, electrons, neutrons, what have you, in the very much more complicated structure you have in a crystal, was beyond their means, beyond their capabilities, and beyond the capability of anybody at the time. You may even say, if you talk about computations, and it is a fairly easy but not simple thing to compute the energy situations in the more complicated atoms. But beyond the possibility of almost anybody to make computations of the energy situations, stabilities, and so on, for solid state, and the continuous solid state is again a simpler state of material than the surface. So you might be naughty and say that if you could gain easily a Nobel Prize by going into the quantum physics, finding some new principles in atomic quantum physics and so on, then why go into something to help the chemists? Mm-hmm. If you look upon catalysis, there were quite a few physicists after all who laid the foundation for what later has been very useful, and again I would mention Fermi and Hevesi, but quite a few others. And I don't think it's my job today to go into that. So you asked what I thought was the interplay. In the 30s, I would say the interplay was not very efficient, mm-hmm, between theoretical physics and theoretical chemistry. We thought, when we started, there was far more to be learned for and useful for a chemist's interest in catalysis than so far had been, shall we say, realized. Well, we, of course, I'm not just thinking about the few Danes we were in this early stage of the company, but also our friends around the world. And there were amazingly few people who were interested in that field of, fundamental chemistry is maybe too strong a word, but that field of chemistry that was called catalysis. For instance, it wasn't until one of the last years before the war that the first group in the United States was set up focusing on catalysis. I think we called it the Philadelphia Club, and if I remember correctly, the first year 16 people assembled. And now international catalysis societies, mm-hmm, can bring thousands of people together. And and it's interesting to note that when you look upon these assemblies, because after all you need a network. If you want to do anything useful in the sciences, already in the 30s and probably before, one needed a network where people came with different luggage. You needed mathematicians, for instance, to tell you what you could and couldn't compute, because you couldn't handle mathematics the way that, for instance, Brønsted did by, he said, the integration of this equation will probably look like this. Therefore, you need a network. And it's amazing to see that in this very early, I think this American grouping was maybe one of the more interesting, in this very early years, they did have a very small network, but really they did not have much knowledge about the theoretical physics. There were people like Otto Beck, the Farkases, Eklop, and such people, and some Russians who had come to the United States, like, I think, Pavel Ibachev and so on. But you can always look up who they were. Then we thought around 1950 that maybe the contribution from physics to catalysis was such that an understanding of catalysis, of the mechanism and the state of the catalyst, was around the corner, almost. Some people even said that it wouldn't be too far into the future. One could sit and engineer catalysts, and also sit at the desk and find out how would a reactor look. Okay, it didn't happen. It is maybe about to happen in a very limited way. But when we had this, again, unjustified optimism, we spent an awful lot of effort and money on putting together experimental units which could help in this, and looking into all sorts of spectra, what have you. I won't dwell into the details of that, because that you can find easily. But we were, of course, in a way hoping that you could study the catalyst with the focus on the surfaces sufficiently in detail by these new techniques, ultra vacuum spectra and what have you, ESCA, Raman, infrared, and a little later synchrotron studies, and then get an understanding. So again, we had this unjustified optimism, but in spite of the fact that it was too early, things came out of this effort. In our company, a good deal later, and headed by some of my colleagues, and last year the responsibility of one of our sons who's working here, Henrik, we then thought that we could realize an old idea in different manners. The old idea was to try and use physical measurement of catalysts in situ, meaning that we had a small reactor, could also be big, where you could study the kinetics of the reaction, side reactions, and then at the same time make physical measurements of the catalyst. Actually, some of us had thought about this in a very primitive way, because we thought it would one could even take a huge big reactor, for instance shift reactor, and put it on a support that would allow you to weigh it with kilos exactitude, and then simply see how during the reaction did the weight of the catalyst change. I'm just saying that because in order to do such, in a way, advanced studies, you don't necessarily have to have big physics or $1 million equipment. But We had started during the war already the in situ behavior of vanadium catalyst for oxidation of SO2, and done that by quite simple spectroscopic means, and found a lot about what really was the catalyst composed of during reaction at the different part situations through a reactor. And we had some pleasure publishing that. Nobody read it during the war, but then years after, people found that that was the first in situ examination of kinetics and physics at simultaneously. And therefore we emphasize that all the time. We said, you know, we are uninterested in learning how a catalyst is composed when you have made it or when you evacuate it from a reactor. We're interested to know how does a catalyst look under actual operating conditions, also in situ work. I think maybe I can say that we were maybe the ones who took this initiative, but certainly later when this got more sophisticated, some of us, the group here, did pioneer work. Part of the work was done, as I said, in with more primitive methods. One push ahead came through the advent of the Mossbauer spectroscopy. I don't know whether you know about that. Mm. Well, Mossbauer is a German physicist who got a Nobel Prize for his work to see how you could use the spectra emitted from an atomic transition from, for instance, outer shell to second outermost shell to measure the situation in which you found an atom like the ones emitting the radiation. For instance, iron is an atom very well suited for Mossbauer. It's spelled Mossbauer. And you see, if you take iron and react it with something, make an iron compound, obviously the iron is changed in its properties by reacting. Similarly, if you use iron as a catalyst, the iron will be changed in its energy situation and so on by the reaction. And the Mossbauer method is elegant because the changes physically to iron used as a catalyst from iron in another usual state is very, very, very small. And therefore, if you emit radiation from a radioactive ion, then this is absorbed by iron in the same stage as the emitter, more or less fully. Mm-hmm. And you just have to keep them at a distance in stationary thing. But if there's a little bit of changes to the situation of the two iron atoms, then it is absorbed only if you move the two iron particles in relation to each other. And as you can find, they can therefore find the changes in the condition of the iron atom under any change that you let it undergo by putting up such a Mossbauer experiment and find what is the velocity or relative velocity in relation to the two atoms where you have maximum absorption. This is an extremely elegant method, and the energies you can measure there are extremely small, and it is one of the most exact methods in science to identify, for instance, energies. It would correspond to being able to measure the distance to the moon with an exactitude of millimeters or centimeters. So that therefore was very interesting for catalysis, because really under catalysis the change in the energy situation for the catalytically active atoms is very often very small. Therefore this is very elegant method. Unfortunately not so many elements which can be used for that. But anyhow, the advent of Mossbauer some 30 years ago, something like that, caused some of us to study that. We indeed put up a Mossbauer laboratory here, and my son, for instance, studied that, made his thesis in Stanford using Mossbauer. And then many other things came, and to make a long story short, we now have a situation where you can make in situ experiments in cyclotrons. We have our own, practically our own lab in the cyclotron in Hamburg, collaborate with other cyclotrons. We are the largest user, industrial user of the cyclotron installations in Germany, amazingly. You can use X-rays, you can use simultaneously X-rays and other rays, you can use Raman spectral lasers and many other things. And, we were the first to do certain of these things where really you got information. And Sir Thomas in England, he recently got a large premium for it, but he was number two, as he also admitted himself in literature. And we are quite interested in this, and maybe a little bit proud of the way in which we have been able to make this in situ work with many catalyst types, many reactions, and also with fractional reactions, because the catalyst would at the top of the reactor have one situation, mm-hmm. At the bottom another. Kinetics are also completely different. Very often you cannot find one set of kinetics valuable from inlet to outlet where you are close to equilibrium. And this has been one of the major efforts in the world. I would think that we are about 10-20 in the world groups who pursue this. And this is really a marriage between physics and chemistry, where you can go out in the lab and see it, look at it, see here it is. Here we have the spectrograph, and here we have the reactor. And another thing which is interesting is that in the meantime, the physicists who, between the wars, didn't take much interest in catalysis, they are taking interest in it. They are interested in surface physics much more than they used to be. And we are privileged in Denmark because we have three groups working together. We participate in it. To find out to what extent quantum physics allows you to find the energy situation between gases, for instance, and a surface. They started some year. It is one of the parts in sciences where this country is leading. And it started years ago, where a man, a fellow, his co-worker, he worked here at that time. Now he is a professor at university, and he's a physicist. And he showed how you could determine the energy changes when a hydrogen molecule approaches a metal surface. But that was, of course, very theoretical, not generally applicable. But in the meantime, they have worked, and therefore developed a number of methods enabling one to see the energy situation when even a molecule, a more complicated structure, approaches a surface. Surface of reality, real interest for catalysis. And of course, this is what it is all about. How does a molecule approach a surface? How does a surface have to look to make it approach a surface, to retain it in a situation where the transformation required, activation required for catalysis takes place, and release it afterwards? And this is a thing that we hope was around the corner 30 years ago, but we are in the corner now. Yeah. It's certainly not a sharp corner, but we are in the corner. And therefore, obviously, we participate very much in that. We had this chap working for us. We still have him, a very intimate collaboration. There are two or three groups outside this one. We do not ourselves any longer do the theoretical work here. It's done in collaboration, joint financing, things like that. We have one group at the University in Denmark, in Copenhagen, one at the University in Aarhus. We have our group here. Then we have, obviously, in the network of friends around the world, others participating. And that is another answer to what you asked. Now, there's been another development, so to speak, that has created the situation we are in. That is an interest in surfaces coming from other quarters than catalysis, particularly silicon, semiconductors, and so on. There, and we've been lucky that we also, at an early time, some 35, 40 years ago, took an interest and created a small plant making single crystal silicon. And we therefore took a big interest in understanding the surface, which to a large extent is where the action takes place. And not the least when the action is to put something on the surface, oxides or what have you. And we have followed that up. We are still probably one of the three suppliers, maybe the only open supplier of equipment for making very large single crystals in the float zone method. That means where you have the melt, not in a crucible, but melt it through high frequency radiation in a moving band, you might say, between two cylinders that you rotate. And we've been able to develop this technology to at least it's not so bad. And for instance, it being the American government through Pentagon found that in the States you didn't have anybody. Having such technology, manufacturing such single crystals, which are of major importance for sensors for the military, but also for other military, and of course civil purposes. And there the, you had to go into the nature, study the nature of such surfaces in a way that you won't be able to in catalysis. In the silicon industry, you want to have a big single crystal. In catalysis, you want to have very large surfaces, meaning that you cannot have big single crystals, and therefore they're much more difficult to study. So one learned, we learned, and one learned in general, other people did more work than we, a lot about dislocations in the surface. Obviously, it's always been a problem for people working catalysis whether this business of active sites that I mentioned, mm-hmm. that for instance, U.S. Taylor focused on Thompson, those two, whether that had a meaning or was just some sort of a dream. It can, of course, only have a meaning if the surface is not homogeneous, but has certain, shall we say, anomalies, dislocations. And therefore, it's, of course, very interesting to know whether or not these dislocations meant something for catalysis. And if so, how should they be? Should they be steps or swirls or whatever? Should they also be in catalysis combined with a surface analysis different from the chemical analysis of the bulk? And therefore we had an input from that area about the understanding of surfaces, and one also had an input through the development of the scanning tunneling microscope, which is also a very beautiful development, which has also been followed up by groups here in Denmark, and there is no doubt that also in this field we are leaders. There is nobody having the same standing in scanning tunneling microscopy as our people have. This is also acknowledged worldwide. And obviously we have been very active in using it. We are having people working for us in this field, and we have shown with this scanning tunneling microscopy how surfaces of catalytic interest really look, how for instance nickel is placed on another metal surface, and so on. That's been published recently, and we therefore feel that a number of theoretical and experimental and combined tools have been made available to really get an understanding, an in situ understanding of catalysis. That's a very long answer to your question.
I'm going to interrupt you two for 1 second.
The microscopy for that also. We are about to, we had a number of experimental units. We are about to install two very modern electron microscopes. So we'll have some sort of a Scandinavian center for electron microscopy between the Lund University and ourselves.
there are a number of.
Too much.
No, not at all.
Would you like?
Thank you. Other questions that I would like to ask have to do with the development of your interest in in technology transfer to the developing world, and your the evolution of your experiences.
Oh, yeah, I think you are really. Would you like? If you can. I'm sorry.
The development of your activities in technology transfer to the developing world, and also the evolution of your experiences in very large-scale projects and the relationship between those.
Okay. Yeah.
Sort of a diffuse question, but well, it's where
you make the Duke as an octopus with too many arms and too many interests.
No, not at all.
I don't think you could have grown up in the decades I grew up without taking an interest in the so-called third world. And what caused our company to be interested in it, I think, is in a peculiar way associated with catalysis. Because before the war, I was employed by a company making edible oil and therefore cakes for a spotter, soybean cakes, copra cakes, and what have you. And in this connection, we were active partly in this company's own facilities and partly in other facilities. In developing new and better seeds. One point that was of interest was to what extent we could grow seeds as raw material for paddy oil and glycerids, triglycerids in our countries. We spent a lot of work on that, and other people spent a lot of work on that, and part of it was successful, partly not. But obviously that made you very much interested in how you could improve agriculture. It's one of the things I spent a little bit of time on in this book you referred to. And one couldn't see how you could attain optimum productivity in agriculture. I'm talking about as a main agriculture, wheat, rice, whatever you are not specialty, without real good understanding of the interplay between seed qualities, water, and fertilizers, and also micro-fertilizers and other components, and the interplay with insecticides, pesticides, and herbicides, and what have you. And that was a great and growing interest in our country. We had people who were pioneers in much of that work, also some people who were pioneers in the understanding of how you should use fertilizers. And therefore I had as luggage a good deal of connection with the agricultural research institutes in Europe, and also in the States, had close relation with Archer Daniels and Little. And then when we took this interest in catalysis, obviously the main petrochemical industry was and still is ammonia, using about 100 million tons of hydrocarbons a year as feed. And we thought it was not possible to really get into ammonia without also having an understanding of the agricultural developments and all that, and we followed very much all the work that led to the Green Revolution by this wonderful Norwegian Nobel Prize winner, and of course realized how the Green Revolution would in
seats and so on would necessitate a revolution in the use of chemicals in agriculture, and here not the least ammonia and phosphatic fertilizers. And as we were emphasizing ammonia, and still are, I think we are supplying technology to more than 50% of new units being built, then we of course got very much interested in the countries where this green revolution was of particular importance. And here, of course, the biggest group of countries are the then you see we in different ways already between years, my wife and I had a lot of connections with the subcontinent, which is of course the largest area for green revolution, and had many friends there. And after the war, some years after the war, we could travel around in India and so on. And of course, you cannot see such a country even today, just as you could not see the queues waiting for soup in the 30s, without feeling that it is of great interest, and you can maybe say even an obligation to try some way of helping that. And we had the privilege that some of us, some in the circle, not just in the company, could join to help create these development. And my wife and I, at that time, we had, it was a private family company. We had later to change it. We strongly felt that if we had a good technology for making ammonia, we should make the technology freely available to the Indians. That's why we transferred. We had a project to do that. I think that was maybe a little bit special because we transferred not only state-of-the-art knowledge but also an ongoing transfer of technology as developed. Whereas I'm sorry to say that a good many people did in one way or another transfer obsolete knowledge, because really there was no great general understanding of the necessity to see such countries in the third world develop, as there was a general feeling in the wonderful international financial establishment that that was more dangerous than beneficial for the Western world. Well, you have to understand that many of these people have never been out there. They are sitting in their ivory towers, and obviously if you visited India in the early years after liberation and saw the conditions, you felt differently. We are not idealists. We thought that was a good thing to do, an obligation, and the way we transferred it was that we enabled the Indians to build such plants with ever reduced input from export to India, and on that basis, India has been able to develop. On that base, and also because of other things, I mean, we should be very careful not to exaggerate. India has developed competence in a number of areas, started in the fertilizer industry, when you first went out and met them, you could, if you met 20, you had met them all, and some of them were extremely intelligent, of course, but those who were very intelligent were, unfortunately, not very practical, and they lacked knowledge. I think that in this particular area, it would push a little bit to the development of Indian knowledge. Now, when you have a meeting with the Fertilizer Association of India, 2,000 people come, and you have the largest group in the world of competent technologies in this area, which I think is nice. Mm-hmm. And one cannot observe that that has any, this and other similar developments has had any derogative effect on the Western world. To the contrary, I should think that because of the Green Revolution, and also because of the small input we have given, India has only a little hunger. They are badly nourished, undernourished, but they have managed in a way that they would not have been able to manage. So I hope that you will bring a strong message to all the holy green people that if the fertilizer industry has, and chemical industry related to agriculture has done nothing else, they have saved hundreds of millions of people in the subcontinent from hunger. And then you can ask yourself what would have been the consequence of that. So, therefore, it's obviously my wife and I and the whole company, you know, we share this feeling that this was a very worthwhile effort, good thing, but it has been paid for several times over by very extended friendship with wonderful people, very good relations, the pleasure it's been to see all this develop, and use in India of our technologies where we, as I said, transfer in certain ways, but we also do have some business, so it's maybe a combination of what we felt as an obligation, but also as an opportunity to do something we should all do. It was very easy. Therefore, you might say that catalysis at an early time for us meant ammonia, which meant fertilizers, agriculture, green revolution, and still will mean that. And obviously in the rich countries like this country, we can allow ourselves to even force people to cut back on use of pesticides and fertilizers and whatnot, because maybe it disturbs the marine biology, biodiversity, and you get some more nitrogen, for instance, in the sea. We can allow ourselves all that sort of really poorly founded, scientifically founded attitude. But in the third world, all this is a must. And maybe some of these things disturb the drinking water, but then you can purify the drinking water because you have chemical methods for doing that. But you cannot, in the world at large, allow yourself not to use industrial methods and products just because the green have found that maybe under certain conditions it can maybe create life for lobsters a little bit more difficult. Actually, that's what happened here. Yes, you see, they forced us to go through a $2 billion program for conserving the water in the Baltic and in Kattegat, as we call it, by cutting down on certain levels and doing all sorts of other peculiar things, because some years back somebody showed on television five dead lobsters, saying that they had passed over because of some fertilizer into yes. Well, that's a general thing. I mean, the green people are undoubtedly having a good case in many, many ways, because we were lax in many, many ways of attending to the environment. But lots of what they are saying is sheer nonsense. Lots of it is uncertain, non-proven science. And some of it is proven. But if you go back 40, 50 years, none of us who were interested in that, it so happened we were, none of us could even make a journalist interested in writing about the bad effects of diesel exhaust, for instance. None of us. We developed technology, and quite a few others did, that had no interest whatsoever. Then all of a sudden, Mrs. Brundtland, Norwegian Prime Minister, she was to be re-elected, she hoped, that she invented the green propaganda as a vehicle for re-election. That's what it has been to a large extent until this day. And that's no damn way of handling problems which have a major resource impact, a major social impact, a major impact on whether you can feed people or not. So that's a hell of a way to deal with what is basically a good case.
It seems that along with fertilizers, you have research programs that are involved in the energy area as well in this connection, these technical solutions to energy issues, thinking of the DME and biomethanol.
Well, we have for many, many years been active in other fields than ammonia.
Right.
I don't think a company like ours can develop if you focus on narrow area.
Mm-hmm.
But we have always focused on whatever had to do with catalysis. And could many other things we worked on from the beginning, like sulfuric acid, methanol, and hydrogenation, mm-hmm. and oxidation, metallics, and what have you. And in many of these areas, we could not afford to follow it up ourselves, so we in a way gave away knowledge and ideas we had in exchange for some business we otherwise couldn't have. If we had been very rich from the beginning, we probably wouldn't have developed, because it's a danger to be very rich. But if we had had a little more money, we could have to, for instance, the field that Bob Landau went into, because we were way ahead of him in this. But we at a very early time were interested in refining. As a matter of fact, sometimes we do act as contractors or completely responsible for a plant. We just immediately after the war built the first grassroots refinery built in Europe after the war in Sweden. So obviously we took a big interest in refining as a field for catalysis. Your question was more what we think about the energy field. Refining is of course a very important part of the energy field for automotive energy and other energy. Of course it is. We have been interested in following developments of catalytic processes in refining we have particularly been interested in hydrogenation, hydrotreating. And another case where we took complete responsibility for refining was in the third, in around 70, where we were responsible for the first all hydrogen refinery built in Kuwait, in the world, by the way, but built in Kuwait. And well, there was the stream that wasn't hydrogenated, so every stream was purified in anticipation of what the market would mean. When that was decided in the 60s, you had no green propaganda and all that sort of business, but there was already a growing feeling that one had to remove sulfur, obviously to use diesel oil with 2-3% sulfur. That is really not nice. And that was, by the way, a surprising innovative initiative on behalf of the emir of Kuwait. At that time he was just a sheikh. Sheikh Jaber, who was a very delightful person, I know very well. And in this situation, we were responsible for the refinery construction and so on. And one of our colleagues took the job of managing the refinery for a number of years after that. But we did not have available technology of our own. So therefore, what we did was to introduce hydrogenation technology that we knew about, developed by others like Chevron, UOP, Gulf, what have you. And that, to a certain extent, was a little bit unfortunate, because we got a lot of knowledge there that for some time we thought precluded us from moving ahead ourselves. And we therefore put our research programs a little bit on the back burner until some years after that we finally was started up. But ever since then, we've been very active. We have our own process, our own catalyst for a number of these, and we intend to be one of the main players in refinery technology. Well, we had unjustified optimism, but I think now the optimism is a little bit more justified, and we expect to be fairly near the front line. You said we were involving ourselves in that. There are, of course, a number of reasons why we are. One is that it is catalysis,
right.
And we were instrumental immediately after war also in many developments in refinery catalysis, together with Toby Keith and Gustav Ekloff, early UOP, and all that sort of thing. And the other thing is that now for a number of years it's been much in the public eye, this reformulated gasoline business and all that, again with an awful lot of poor science as basis for propaganda. But it's been much in the public eye, and third thing is that the general process technology we develop for chemical industry and so on can be introduced to a much larger degree than it has been to refinery engineering. And then the last thing, which happens at intervals, almost secretly, is that the big ones are downsizing their research. They are, many of them are licensing by the thousands, university graduates, and some are closing some of their research activities. Those who are purely refiners, not in upstream or downstream, well, not in upstream activities, they are in many cases under very poor economic conditions. Prince Dimitri is bankrupt. After all, the largest refinery group in the Middle East. And therefore, it looks as if all those in refining are putting themselves a little bit in the hands of the UOPs and such people. And we are probably the largest group, a single group, developing understanding of the fundamentals in hydrotreating catalysts. I think Henrik, I hope you will see for luncheon, is considered one of the leaders there, and also the group around him. And it's also interesting to see that in refining, where in a way they have something they also called standard refinery engineering practices, that they are more realizing that the processing units are not just black boxes that they somehow get, that they have to interest themselves much more for how they really react inside, how things are inside these black boxes. And this has benefited us greatly and also justified that we went through it, because I believe that many people think that one of my colleagues was the first to do well-founded reactor design work, Dr. Kerr, who got many international recognitions for that. So that was as far as the refineries are concerned. In other fields, obviously, one of the main areas of interest today is how to make good use of remote cheap natural gas. It appears that most of the natural gas resources are in remote areas where you either have to build chemical plants or other uses for hydrogen and then export the products, or where you have to use the gas by reinjection, which is doubtful in many cases, or flare it, which of course the Greens don't like. I think it's also very wrong. Or try to tie into international networks for energy like pipelines. There are vast quantities of gas which has a very low value at the wellhead, and where it's interesting to see where you can come from gas to liquids and export liquids. To export gas as LNG, of course, is a growing concern, ever developing, but it's very expensive. You land gas at $3+ per million BTU in Japan, even if you start with a value much below one in Qatar or Bontang in Indonesia. And therefore, there is, you might say, a $2 or more per million BTU pre raw material. Okay? You can use the Fischer-Tropsch process. I'm the only living one who has worked with both Fischer and Tropsch. The only active one, I think. As in South Africa, made synthetic oil, which is a possibility. You can make methanol, which is a diminishing possibility, unless certain things happen. And you can make DME, which is the probably most attractive diesel substitute. So we are very much interested in that. We collaborate with Amoco, but now it's BP. And we expect that there might be such a project going in the near future for supply to India. But you have the new normal situation that if you want to introduce something new, then normally you cannot introduce it by droplets. You have to build a plant, big investment, in this case maybe $1 billion, and you introduce at a time with no market. So what do you do? So we have a logistic problem. I think we are solving it, and that it will happen. We are interested in building such plants. We're not interested in running such plants. We don't have $1 billion. Not quite. And we hope it will happen. But in such areas, you have to have a lot of patience. So besides arrogance and undue optimism, patience has been our main raw material. And then, of course, there are also other things you might be interested in the energy field. We are very much interested in power stations where chemistry can play a role in exhaust cleaning. We are very much interested in gas turbine areas. I've personally taken a great interest in, because the chairman for SAS for many years looked at some of their technical problems and got already some 35 years ago. I'm very much involved in the development of the aero engines and all of that. Pratt & Whitney, Rolls-Royce, General Motors, General Electric, what have you. I still see an interest in for us in this field. We believe that we have processes which, combined with gas turbo units, can increase the yield. We think that there is a burner technology that is of interest. We think that there is a materials technology that we can introduce, and we think that there is an exhaust problem where you can maybe come with a power solution through recovery of energy by chemical process. For instance, if you take methanol, if you want to use methanol as turbo fuel, now there will be too much of it because of MTBE's reduction, then you can use the energy in the exhaust as input to the energy in conversion of natural gas to methanol. And there are many other things we're interested in this field. Then, of course, if you look upon mega plants for using natural gas for chemical purposes, I mean, you are really looking at a very big energy station. It's a power plant with a little bit of catalyst in it. And for instance, study job we are doing together with one of the three largest oil companies visualizes the manufacture of 16,000 tons of methanol equivalent per hour. And that's an awful lot of methanol. That's five times the largest. Five times the largest existing power. And this is a 200 megawatt power station. We're also very much interested in the real combination of power and chemical synthesis, because if you convert your raw material by gasification one way or another, then you have upfront the synthesis gas. It's very cheap to run this once through a chemical process, and then that the unconverted gas, for instance, unconverted superphysiotrope, that push a gas turbine, and you have a combined efficiency in excess of 60%. And therefore there are many, many areas where you can combine chemistry and power, where for years and years we have always been forced to do it because the standard ammonia plant we built is a 40 megawatt power station. We're building some bigger ones now.
There's definitely an economics and geopolitical input then about what
this
that
is. You see, well, surely you come back to your early years, because you can't do anything like that without having macroeconomic understanding and a certain standing in it. You can't. You can't do that without having access to presidents, prime ministers, ministers, governments, and you can't do that without a combination of catalysis and engineering, back to engineering. In the field of gas to liquids via physiotropes, we have very close collaboration with Sasol in South Africa, the only big player making that to the tune of converting 30-40 million tons of coal a year to 10 million tons of synthetic oil. We have revamped one of their plants, revamped 14 units in their big plant. They have two, but it's a big one. Each of these units is equivalent of 1,000 tons of methanol a day. All right, he's making physiotropes. But that means that there in one place we have revamped what is equivalent to 14,000 tons of methanol a day. So we have privileged with very good reference for that. And as the front end in all these gas to liquids business is today has to be based on our process for catalytic oxidation, then we expect to be very, very rich. But unfortunately, it's always delayed. So it seems to be a constant distance to richness of about 5 years.
Did you have another question?
That was about energy, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Do we want a break?
Shall we have a break and go and have lunch?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
That we've asked in some of our previous oral histories have been has been the question: what do you consider to be most important for the future of the development of new technologies, research and development, innovation? What are the critical factors for the future?
In the world or in our company?
Both. We'd be interested in knowing both.
Generally, there are quite a few factors. Firstly, maybe in a way, the overall factor is the attitude owners of companies, whether they are share owners or private owners, take to research and development in-house versus research and development in combination with external sources and internal sources, or research development completely outsourced. And the situation as I see it, that for progress in technology-based industries, you do not need in-house research. And the reason for that is that technology is dirt cheap. If you take any area, the fraction of the payment that goes to the research and development people, those who have been responsible for that, and of total income from new technology projects is very, very small. Even with the highest license payments available, you're only talking about a very few percent. So in a way, technology per se is dirt cheap. If you, with the technology per se, consider patents, rights, access to the use of immaterial rights, experience, without anything else, just information in the form of drawings, specifications, what have you, that will allow you to produce something, then it is really dirt cheap. And this is sometimes surprising, but always not realized, really, in the community. And the reason for it, to a certain extent, may be that when it comes to real new valuable technology research, research results and so on, then they come in most cases basically from efforts in the university community, institute community, where really people aren't, when they start something new, immediately thinking of how to maximize profit from it, and in many cases do not have a possibility, a channel to obtain income, whether to themselves or to universities, for new results. Mm-hmm. And therefore, all it takes for even a high technology company that wants really to market high technology products to be in the front line all the time is that they have ongoing contacts and channels to a network of institutes, universities, and groups where new things happen. And also to a network to people like ourselves who, in a pure business climate, try and do research. This access is easy, but it isn't productive unless the company in question has a group of people able to evaluate research results, to see at an early time whether what is in the pipeline elsewhere can come out as something useful for them. Meaning that although it isn't necessary to do in-house research, it's necessary to have an in-house competence and capability to follow and have connections with developments, with the university world, you might say. And the university world does not want to see people just coming to scout for business, so to speak, to canvas for technology and thinking. You have people who have made a business of doing that, like Lummers, but there are many others also, go-betweens, and so on. And the university world doesn't want to see somebody coming to say, you are very active in protein synthesis, do you have something that we could use and to earn money on? And therefore, although in principle it is necessary to do in-house research, it's necessary to arrange yourself with a group that would be considered a valuable, interesting, and ethical interlocutor, discussion partner, for that area. And normally that, of course, translates into somebody who has to come with something on behalf of this company, and what they have to come with maybe sometimes is ideas, very, very, very rarely, but it is money. So that's one point. Yes. What I'm saying, that in order to be a high technology industry, you do not need to do in-house research. the other attitude you can have as responsible for such a company is, of course, good appraisal of whether or not high technology is useful for you. There's been a big misunderstanding in the industry, and it's almost a cyclic misunderstanding coming and going, that basics are not so interesting, not so necessary. And that is, of course, if it is a permanent view, sheer nonsense, because how can it be very important to make non-basics, these products and so on, if you can't make them without basic chemicals, for instance, or basic machinery. Therefore, I want to take issue with the view where you distinguish between research development and technological progress, very much needed for what we call high technology for today, and for non-high technology. There is no real change. And whether you make basic commodity products or niche specialty products, research is always necessary to make progress. If you take such a basic field as ammonia, I can assure you that the plant you designed today is very different from one you designed 5 years ago. And the advances are maybe not mainly advances which would whet the appetite of innovation-oriented people. Maybe all they are, and that's the case today, are advances in the cost of investment. But to reduce the cost of investment by just a few percent is normally at the same value as to introduce new progress in purchasing, for instance. It's very rarely that you can find any one step in all the areas we have spoken about, and also in manufacture of catalysts, which certainly could be considered a high technology. It's very difficult to find one single step coming out of one single research project that will have a greater importance than a single step that will reduce investment by whatever is normally the case, a few percent, 5%. Therefore, the whole issue of high technology versus commodity, technology for commodity manufacture, that's a fake issue, nonsense, and has guided many efforts, and particularly support from people like the Brussels Group of Prim Simpletons in a completely wrong direction. Right now you see as a herd all the old-fashioned huge big chemical group are all leaving what they call commodity things, cyclic things. They don't want to have to do with that, but they all want to emphasize specialty chemicals or niche products. And they will regret that, and the cycle will regret that. That was my truth. Another bad thing is that
in any company that is not family owned, or owned by a small group of individuals or a single individual, the management and even the board normally doesn't know what the owners want. Do you think that Gaston knows what the millions of shareholders in IBM want? Do you think he cares about what they want? Do you think he cares about finding out what they want in a way that can guide him in his decisions and his in the direction to take? Surely they have the analysts, but the analysts are certainly not representing owners. They are people active in a profession which at best is not contributing to our societies and at worst creating an awful lot of confusion. Because an analyst, he should not have access in the stock market companies and talk about that everybody doesn't have. So therefore normally he has no knowledge that everybody doesn't have, and normally therefore he would not be in a specific position to pass comment or advice related to a company. Of course he may have a lot of general knowledge about this area that could be useful. But unfortunately, more cases than not, analysts, they have somehow had access or may believe that they have access to information that only they have. And in that case, the profession is illegal and highly unethical. Now, at least my point is in this connection that financial analysts or any other working as an advisor in financials is not a channel from what shareholders want to what to the company's management or board. Now, the third thing is that in most, very, very, very many cases, the shareholders don't care one hoot about the company. They're only interested in the share movements, only interested in getting in and out. And therefore, you have a situation where in many, many, many cases, even the shareholders take no interest in the long-range or mid-range welfare of a company. And in technological fields, I'm not talking about retail or anything like that, or fashion industries, but in fields of what I would call bona fide industries, you need long-term programs, internal long-term programs, but the shareholders don't even have an interest in that in many, many cases. Even worse, the shareholders today are to a very large extent people who operate or manage big funds, pension funds, life insurance, what have you, who invest everywhere and where they are measured only by almost the month-to-month value of their portfolio. And if you think that the Western world can survive that sort of short-termism, you are certainly wrong. But the even in cases where a company has a reasonably limited group of major shareholders, it is very, very difficult to observe any situation where such a group tells the management in explicit terms what they want for the company. And the sum total of all that is that more and more industries in the Western world are looking to the short-term results, to next quarter's public paid results, to dividends, and more neglecting creation of value. And that means that more and more companies are forced to cater for such views. That does not mean research and development, unless you are so lucky that you have geniuses employed in your R&D group. But because normal people like all of us here, we cannot manage to bring out results from idea to practical, to first practical use in less than 3, 5, or 10 years. And therefore, this whole attitude, this whole development in going more and more from family-owned companies to multi-owner companies, to shareholder companies, to fund owners, and so on, is certainly with necessity bringing the Western world into a very poor, long-term, stable, and competitive situation. And so that's the worst, as I see it. Now, obviously, we were a family company. We are still a 50% family company. The family is still the main decision maker. We are here, and therefore, I may be a little bit subjective in my views, but I think it's very, very important for us to create a situation in the business world where one re-emphasizes the value of the long term and finds ways of having long term attitudes, irrespective of whether we have to accept that more and more of the capital is in the hands of pension funds and life insurance companies, and somehow make sure that they understand that they must be long-term people. It's ridiculous that that is a difficulty, because if you take, for instance, the Western world, I think we have about 10 trillion, I'm not sure about the figure, but I think we have about $10 trillion in funds of this nature, mm-hmm. all sorts of funds. In my country, we have about a little more than 1 trillion Danish kroner. So I think it's a reasonable figure. That's a very, very, very large share of the capital available for investment in the businesses. And it's a growing fraction, because we more and more want to have good pensions. And things. One should think that those people who are looking at pension, managing pension money, one should think that they realize that these monies are monies that will be paid out from next year to 50, 60, 70 years hence, and that they would understand that they have to emphasize the long term, or at least a term commensurate with the payout. They don't so far, although of course there are differences. Another problem, of course, when we come down to the daily life of such companies like ours, is that we have difficulties recruiting people into science and engineering. A third problem we cover, that is business of understanding the interplay between economies and technology, and between the salesman and the professor.
We were just noticing that
it's not a secret, but it's a confidential thing that
when we have joint hands with the GM and they're joining hands with the order to create. Yeah.
I wonder about that.
I'm sorry?
I wonder about that. As
yeah, every moment. But anyhow, that was the top man.
I think we've just been noticing how much of your time you've taken today. So
yeah,
I thought if
you will allow me another quarter or so, will that finish?
Well, it's up to you. I would.
You're here tomorrow if you want to follow up.
Yeah.
Fine. I mean, I'm not the one who has planned what you want to have on paper.
Right. Well, you've answered all of the questions that I had specifically wanted to ask from my notes. So I thought perhaps we could close just by asking if there's anything that you wanted to return to from the topics we've discussed before earlier, or if there's anything else you'd like to discuss.
Two things about the mission of different people here. I think that the mission of government is, of course, to create a climate for progress in a very general manner. And this has so many aspects we shouldn't even try to touch upon them. But one aspect, of course, is education. And from the narrow angle of ours, we, of course, expect the government to give the industry good scientists and good engineers, etc. And in all fields, we emphasize the education to gain knowledge and gain competence. The other thing is that we think the mission of the players is for the industries, public institutes, like National Research Laboratories, is to again put focus on the production of good scientists, good experimental people, good research people, good people to come from research results to industry, good, shall we say, implementers, and to also produce economists who would be kind enough to spend a little bit of time to understand the sciences and technology, and therefore refrain from expressing their opinion without knowledge. And we expect that is the main role of the industries. The sector research institute, we do not believe much in that. We do not believe it is the role of governments to select which areas need a government-sponsored or funded sector research institute. We mean the industry and business. We are completely capable ourselves of finding where the combination of market forces, scientific developments, and the research activities will lead us. And also, we think we are completely capable of helping solve the problem of the third world, and we think we are maybe in reality, in fact, a better channel, a better vehicle for helping the third world than all the government programs for, I don't know what they call it, grants or supports or whatnot. And we'd like very much to see the public hand giving where you really need to give, and not undertake things like, for instance, the development banks that were useful at a time, but are much less useful today. I loved Jim Robinson. Eugene Black and I were very close friends and all that business. But the World Bank is not a vehicle, nor are the other development banks, of any importance for supplying the capital and the risk capital you need in the third world. Actually, apart from ethics and idealism, the oil and gas industry has done far more to transfer technology and to make the development world and the world semi-developed collaborate with the development world, simply because the third world is to a large extent the supplier world, and the development world is to a large extent the user world, the client world. And this is this mission is not recognized. This mission that global international companies are the best vehicle to create collaboration with the third world for joint progress, that is not normally recognized. And so that was about that mission. Then I do feel that if you look more into the sciences, it is the mission of the Indian universities to focus on fundamentals, but it is the mission of business companies to at least participate in fundamentals sufficiently to be able to follow what is happening. And I myself don't believe that it is acceptable not to have an activity in fundamental research. In another thing about missions and so on, unfortunately, great many companies in many areas, whether it is in global trading, in sales, and in research, and technology, production, management, manufacturing, what have you, many companies do not have the critical mass needed today. Yesteryear, the critical mass for just common mechanical equipment company, engineering company, making equipment, the critical mass was maybe 1,000 people, something like that. That won't do today. It's many times that. The critical mass for, shall we say, chemical synthesis company was maybe the equivalent of 2,000 tons of methanol a day. That won't do today. It's many times. The critical mass of a pharmaceutical company was maybe a turnover of $2-3 billion. That won't do today because of globalization. So if you take a company like ours, a research company focusing on catalysis, we are just a little bit above the critical mass. Great many of our competitors do not have the critical mass. And therefore, you have a mission somehow. That's a joint mission between government, universities, and business. You have a mission to bring those who don't have a critical mass and who deserve it to grow somehow, to merge, to help them, or whatever. This is very important because without that there's no lackbook. What do you mean? Also, there's no growth. There's no, what do you say? The growth in the forest.
Undergrowth?
There's no...
Under seedlings or saplings.
Yeah.
And this is a very big problem. And all these problems, of course, translate also into economy. Therefore, when it comes to development in general way in the Western world, we have to realize this completely new situation concerning critical mass. It's no damn use whatsoever to try and do something if you don't have critical mass or can see that it is around the corner. I mean, why do we think that we are buying several microscopes and the bomb and electron and I don't know what? Because we feel it's a necessity to be on top of this question. And that's a very big problem. Now, some governments are, like all Western European governments, they are emphasizing start-ups, new start-ups. Fine, that's wonderful. If I wanted to create growth in Scandinavia, give me 2 or 3 billion kroner, I will hand them out in parcels of half a million to 10 million to 2,000 people out there, of which I know many, who would deserve it. They would bring out something new, they would work 22 hours a day with a few people, they will come with something new. And they will come up to this, and then they are dead. Because their lift doesn't go beyond the mezzanine. Therefore, it's far more important to give people what is called mezzanine capital. And then you talk about tens of millions, when something good that has to live in the modern international competitive world, and assuming it's of importance, then you have to be to have an instrument that cannot only be venture capitalists, because of obvious reasons. That allows people who deserve it to come and get 10, 50, 100 million to use things, and then at least come into a situation where others think it's reasonable to help them gain the critical mass in whatever area. That's very, very important. Otherwise, we are lost. And this emphasis on start-ups, fine, but it's a fraction of what is needed also in the world of capital. And then I see that we still have in the very all-important energy area to find our feet. People have not understood what it means to all industries that the Arabs, they sit on the energy. And of course we can move all industry to the Arabs, whether they live in Indonesia, Malaysia, or in Qatar, or in Chile. That's a major undertaking, and therefore that is a mission where you still have to find the solution by a combination of geopolitical, economic, and heavy industry efforts, because these things are not peanuts. And then you have big problems about patents and whether or not new technologies should be made generally available, and in what form. And as we haven't discussed the pharmaceutical industry, and it's none of my business, although I did serve on the board of some companies, then you have a completely new situation, as we all know. I won't trouble you with that. So I think that in a very primitive, a farmer's way of reasoning, all those out there, all the players from the Prime Minister, by the way, a nice chap but useless, all those out there, they need to understand what their missions are and how this has changed by globalization. And then another overriding problem we have is timing. We want to see Russia, old Russia, change to reform to a market-oriented policy overnight. That's the greatest crime that has been committed, by trying to push the Russians to go from the centralist economy to a market-oriented economy in months or years, where it would take generations. That has created huge poverty and killed more people than we have been able to kill under the Cold War, and may eventually kill more people than we killed under the Warm War. And you just go over there and see what happened. And so this question of timing is very difficult now. We want to see one world. I certainly want to see one, but not too fast. We want to see WTO having all, every country included, China, all of them. Now, it cannot be done. It is ridiculous to try and pursue ideas which by any analysis of anybody who just knows a little bit would take years, decades, or generations to implement, to push them through. It's ridiculous. We're pushing through Euroland. Now, everybody thought that, with the exception of Mike Serby, we thought that the Euro would be a smash hit. It's a complete fiasco. And it's a miracle that if it doesn't go from bad to worse. Because how can you force people to work under the same conditions in all respects when they are very different? I mean, it ain't reasonable. And that's what they are trying to. Now that we elected Cody, who's a rather nice chap, by the way, an old-time professor and a poor industrial leader, but a very nice chap. But he was a very poor industrial leader. I mean, you came here to hear some facts. Now, they have elected him. The first thing he says, we also have to have same taxation in all your land countries. So we have one currency. We're not a member, as you know, of the currency. But we have one currency, one set of laws for the labor market, one set of standards, one set of patents, one law for make all technology available to everybody, one interest rate, one budget rule, no more than 3% deficit, one money, monetary policy, and one inflation policy, and then on top of that, one tax policy. At the same time, we believe in the Bible being the market economy, competitive market economy. How the hell can you compete if all conditions are the same, and then you have WTO rules on top of all that? How do you compete then? By swindle or by what? By sending sexy girls as sales people, or what? How do you compete? And it's all an illusion. And that's just because we are getting ahead of ourselves in certain areas and falling behind in others. Like innovation in Western Europe. We're falling behind, not behind you, but not only behind you, very much behind you, but also behind, I should think, others, and even the subcontinent is catching up generally, slowly. So,
well, thank you very much for all of your time today. I think
make sure.